All right, technical difficulties aside, Pascal very accurately went through the phenomenon that we're now experiencing in the United States by going through the phenomenon of the mass strike. Now, in every single state across the board, you have what, on the one side, a lot of the media is trying to paint as being something that was just being pulled up by the, you know, special interest groups or, you know, Rush Limbaugh followers or something. But that's bullshit, because when you look at the actual composition, not just of the age of people who are protesting, but this thing knows no race, no age, no monetary bracket. You've got people of all shapes and colors from all across the board of America who are all equally ready to lynch their local congressman because of their support for Obama's health reform bill. Now, in a period like this, people use the words mass strike. And if you ask most people on the street, they've got no clue what that means. They think the word mass and they think of, you know, many people, a lot of people, okay. But what LaRouche is getting at is that in periods like this, there's actually a scientific principle at work, which has to be understood properly if the potential which arises when people act in a way that they don't necessarily understand what is causing their actions to be in a certain way. They just know that everything has changed, their children's lives are at stake, their grandparents' lives are at stake, they've lost their jobs, and it's going to get worse. They only see darkness in the future. They don't necessarily know what's driving them self-consciously to act the way they do. But to take advantage of it for the better, to have something, to have that rage directed towards something constructive rather than something of anarchy, you need to see this very scientifically. And as such, these periods in history that occur, when you look just at the last 600 years from the Renaissance to today, you've got these certain moments that just sort of stand out. You know, not every moment is equal, but you've got these moments around the Renaissance where you have a flourishing of ideas, of discoveries, of science, and of medicine. Right? You've got these periods around the 1770s of revolutions, right? The American Revolution followed by another one in France. You've got all the way through to the present. And often today, people make the very common assumption in our society when asked, well, why don't we have any more great revolutions like an American Revolution? Why don't we have that type of atmosphere? Why don't we produce the Abraham Lincolns or the Da Vincis? The Renaissance, in its own right, was a very important revolution. Why don't we have that? And what you have in our society is the misconception or the to answer with, well, you know, it's not the Renaissance period anymore. Or, you know, like, oh, the Revolution, well, that was a product of the Enlightenment period. You know, people used to think, you know, they used to think rationally then or something. Now we don't, now we're in a different period. So people, it's a very formulistic model that people have in their minds that the age produced the minds, produced the moments. Whereas they're not thinking about, well, what were the ideas circulating or the points of tension that were being created by the adherence to bad ideas or the ability to recognize good ideas and act accordingly in those periods that caused the age to occur, that caused the greater preponderance of geniuses to flourish in certain periods than others, right? And that's what we have to become much more comfortable with in our own minds, is understanding that time as such is not linear. It's not something you just hang events on. But we're living through it right now. No moment exists by itself, but as a product of a continuum in the past that is resulting in a certain flow towards, you know, the future. So as much as people want to live in the now and just enjoy the moment while they can't see a crisis on the streets right now and, you know, there's not people burning shit, it's an illusion, because we know that the reality of the insanity governing the thoughts of, you know, $24 trillion of bailouts in 12 months. What the fuck, right?
How much?
$24 trillion, going. And it's going to be increasing if the idea that money isn't the source of value doesn't get destroyed very quickly, because the people governing the policies that are permitting this to occur and that are cutting, that are rationalizing that you have to cut costs to social programs and other things to get that money are living by false ideas, which we know if we adhere to, the result will be anarchy. So what's best, to wait for that to occur to try to like live in the moment when things seem comfortable, or to act in the future that you know is going to happen to prevent the inevitable from occurring? Right. And with what type of ideal will we act upon? Because we could, you know, there's various ways of intervening. There's good ways of intervening on things and bad ways, as any imperialist will vouch for. You know, George Bush's idea of intervening to stop the inevitable in Iraq is not exactly the type of model you want to have in your mind, necessarily, when you conceive of freedom or peace. So the point in this class I'm going to try to go through very quickly is, well, as quickly as I can, but is this quality of axioms that grip a society. Because when you look to history to find out what's causing the current, or to inform your analysis of the current crises, which everybody should be doing anyhow, one can't help but notice that in order for certain revolutions to occur successfully, certain axioms or certain self-evident assumptions about how the universe works or what is our human role within it have to be first tackled. Without dealing with these things, you simply can't have a solution. It's impossible. I briefly mentioned this $24 trillion bailout where people are obsessed with just saving the banks because all the banks are bankrupt. But you have a lot in our society that are deeply embedded in our current culture that weren't there before, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. These cultural assumptions have fluctuated quite a bit. Whereas in the 1950s and 60s, you actually had a certain sense that mankind wasn't just another beast. Eh? We weren't just a virus on the purity of Mother Gaia scarring her. People actually had a conception that technology and science wasn't just a thing you do, but it was a product of discoveries. And that when they were applied, they could make people's lives better. Revolutionary thought, eh? You could like wipe out disease and bring sanitation to areas. Whereas today, you'd be hard-pressed to really find this. It's really an extraordinary person in society that tends to have that intuitively in them, especially after going through a whole educational program since you're a kid, watching Al Gore's movies, forced, you know, repetition in your mind that, you know, your species is a mistake. Essentially, that's what the conclusion is. And that there is no future, right? The future is actually going to types of qualities of energy like wind and solar that bring you back to a quality of energy source that we had in the medieval ages, where you have to, the idea of the future is the past. That's what it's been converted to since we've destroyed the Apollo space missions and these other things. So you investigate these things in our culture to sort of, which are necessary in order to understand the political or economic insanities, which everybody should have a problem with. So I think while we're all here. And the best way to inform your actions, again, like I said, is when you go to history and you see how did the great souls deal with this problem again and again. And you'd go, of course, not to just any point in history, but you'd go to those singularities to figure out, well, who are the main figures, the main leaders of those periods that were shaping, inspiring, or the inverse, the people to act according to either reason or fear, you know, just random shit. So I thought what would be fun in this class would be to begin, because what I'm going to be doing, obviously what Pascal pointed out a few times, is that I would be looking at a certain juxtaposition of the mess of the French Revolution in 1789 that went on for another 5-6 years. And in doing so, I don't think it would be very competent to just look at it by itself. But you'd have to look at it, and the only way to understand it is as... Because, I mean, people tend not to see that revolution as a great role model for today's society. And if you do, there's something wrong with you. Because the thing was a giant bloodbath. But you would want to see why it resulted in such a bloodbath when so many of the participants and founders organizing it were so necessary for the success of the American Revolution, simply a decade and a bit prior. Because these ideas that resulted in the American Revolution, that governed it, and that took a certain feudal type of population under the serfdom of a British oligarchy in America, farmers, to rise above their limitations to fight for a principle, and that resulted in the establishment of a form of government whom today represents the only solution for mankind. We know that didn't happen in France, but yet, why not, right? It seemed like the dynamic was going that way. So you got to understand the French Revolution as a response by what we're getting at here is the British, which is totally overlooked today. People have a big problem with it. They block on the British a lot, even though that we're still a dominion of the British Empire here in Canada under a governor general. If anybody didn't know that, you could check that out. But the British wanted to ensure that there was never going to be again another American revolution with those principled ideas that occurred in any other nation. Now, that didn't occur because we know that these ideas were unstoppable, still are, though the British try. And now, what I was going to do is, by looking at the comparison of what makes, because the question arises in my mind, right, like what makes a successful revolution to a fucked up revolution, one that just didn't go well, how do you know, all moments in time aren't created equal, some are more important than others, some are more successful, but all revolutions aren't equal either. So what separates a good from a bad? And for that, again, you'd look at time, because you'd see, well, what was the form of society which existed before the revolution? There's the revolution, you know, this moment of change, and then something after. So you have a before and you have an after. Now, because we have the ability of the human mind to compare, you know, change, one would ask oneself, well, were things better after the revolution relative to before? And if I think we can firmly find certain standards that allow us to answer that question, then I think we'll pretty much know what to do again today in terms of what types of thoughts need to be protected and which need to be attacked. Okay, so the American Revolution first, because first we have to get a certain sense of what are these axioms that were holding the population back that prevented them from acting. And to do so, I figured I would look at briefly at some of the organizing that was fought for by a gentleman named Thomas Paine, who I'm sure some of you guys have heard about, who aren't members.
Thomas Paine,
yeah. Ever hear of him?
Hardman Paine.
Paine with an E at the end of it. Now, Paine, he was a man invited to America by Benjamin Franklin in 1776. And he quickly got on the board writing probably the most widely circulated pamphlet ever at that point, which is called Common Sense. Right? It's if the greatest ideas are generally communicated with the quickest means, then you can imagine that this embodied some of the greatest ideas of mankind, because it was only about 38 pages. But this, which circulated about 200,000 copies, most were read many, many times, had some of the most principled concepts that tackled what Paine wanted to get at were three main obstacles, which was, I mean, every farmer knows at that point that your father, your grandfather, and your kids will always be under a system of a British constitution with a British empire that will do all sorts of things to tax you and to take your food and to, you know, come in with their soldiers to rape your women once in a while, and it just happens, you know, that's part of life. There's certain things about that you can't stop, because the British Constitution is simply a representation of the divine right of kings. God, at some point in time, you don't know when, I mean, but he bestowed kings upon the earth who had special rights, and that's why you got a government, is to protect that, right? And then, keep in mind, it's not just the king, but also, and this is the kicker, this is the real crux that's good to really focus on, because most Canadians still haven't gotten over this one. But the king's kids and grandkids and great-grandkids at some point in time, we're given the right by God to rule your kids, or your great-great-granddaddy's kids and yourself. So your progeny and your posterity is just thus chained to the rule of, you know, the arbitrary authority of a king. And that's the way things work. So Paine saw that that's not going to happen. I mean, any society that really holds on to that is not going to have a revolution. It's just, no. So to get at the result, which I figured I would read quickly, I was going to read quickly at the beginning of the Declaration of Independence, the first couple of lines, really, just to get a certain flavor of what was created. And then we're going to look at a couple of the arguments that Paine put forth before he jumped into France. All right. Slideshow, right? Yeah. Good. Okay, Pat, you want to read into the mic? Yep. Come. Pick a mic, any mic.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute the new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall see most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's turn back on again. So that wasn't self-evident for most people, but at the conclusion of at least the first War of Independence, that was the result. A form of government where that became the mandate of that society, of that government. And any law that went against or infringed upon those rights became the metric for your society to look upon and organize themselves accordingly to even create a new government with that maintains those principles in a more perfect way. So that's a pretty set, that's a pretty good bit of instruction there, especially when you relate it to, let's say, the Canadian Constitution, when our preamble from 1867, granted, it was updated in the early 80s, but our Constitution still stands. It says that the purpose of our existence as a nation is to uphold the interests of the sovereign. Right? So yeah, we got a queen, that's our Constitution, that's our, you know, that's the general gist of it. something else I wanted to say, but I forgot. Fuck. Okay. So, Thomas Paine had to take these these assumptions of people born in a British Dominion and mock the hell out of them. And of course the pamphlet, which you guys can get online, he does a pretty good job of it. But first what he starts doing by hitting at first the pamphlet is organized in a very scientific way where there are no real assumptions. He's looking at everything from any important concepts like government, he thoroughly doesn't just assume you have an understanding of, but he'll go back and say, well, what are these things, governments that we have, right? And he investigates, well, how do we best understand them? Because the first two points he's addressing are the divine right of kings and the British Constitution, the British setup. What is that? First, he says that, well, most people tend to really love the British government or the British setup because you have what's called a perfect balance of powers. You have a king that has veto right or sort of veto rights on any other policies that are put forth. You've got a commons for the common folk, the commoners, that's the house or the parliament, that can veto the king. Then you've got the House of Lords for the aristocracy. And one of them is voted, right, which is the House of Commons, that's what we do every once in a while. Then you got the House of Lords, which you're just born into, or you're appointed by the queen, or whichever monarch is sitting. Then you got the monarch, and you're born there because you're in the right bloodline. Everyone can veto each other, and everyone can check each other. So that's being heralded today as being the best thing, because it's sort of being seen as being, well, you know, everyone's, it's the best way to maintain stability and security, because nothing can change if everybody's interests are so.
Which House of Commons, House of what?
Lords.
Lords, yeah.
Yeah, and the king.
Yeah.
The king. So,
okay.
So of course, Pain says no. That's ridiculous, because it's full of contradictions. There's paradoxes that arise. The main one is that if you really did want to hold true to the fact that the king was there by divine authority of God, then why would he need to be checked, first of all? Right? And why would he be given the veto right on the commons unless it was assumed that he was also more wise than the commons? But why would the commons be given a veto right on him, on his decisions, if it's not assumed that the commons are more wise than the king? Like, these are crazy paradoxes. Like, why would you allow a government that has all these contradictions to it? He says, well, what is a government anyhow? He says, well, mankind comes together out of a need to supply his needs and his wants. He starts building up the principles of a physical economy in a certain sense. He says, you know, you've got like five families and they come together, figure before there was money in tribal times, and their union, they're working together, made their lives infinitely more efficient than any one of them working individually. So they could share, there's a certain division of labor, not everyone had to cook and clean and make their own clothes and all this stuff for themselves. But so you had this new improvement of the quality of life, the wants and the needs of the society. He says, well, let's say the first governance probably would have occurred, and he speculates, you know, but under a tree of some sort, where people would have had to have convened. Everyone would have been a member of this first parliament under a tree. Yeah, like your alawa palab concept. And everyone would have had an equal say. So the idea right there that there was already an arbitrary authority of God's will to pick a king is not really, doesn't make that much sense. Right. It was likely, though, that at some point when the tribe got bigger, families multiplied, that not everyone could participate all the time, especially when people had to travel longer distances, so you had to appoint certain representatives of areas, families. And sure enough, that's probably how it would have unfolded in all likelihood. The form of setup of what we have thus is just completely irrational on a variety of reasons. Now, he asked the first question. I've picked certain few that just kind of embody the arguments he's making, but you guys should all read it when you get the chance. The first point he addresses is, how came the king to a power which the people are afraid to trust and always obliged to check? Such a power could not be the gift of a wise people, neither can any power which needs checking be from God. Yet the provision which the Constitution makes supposes such a power to exist, as does the Canadian Constitution. Of the divine right? There is another and greater distinction for which truly no truly natural or religious reason can be assigned, and that is the distinction of men into kings and subjects. Male and female are the distinctions of heaven. But how a race of men came into the world so exalted above the rest and distinguished like some new species is worth inquiring into, and whether they are the means of happiness or of misery to mankind. Yeah. These are keep in mind, farmers all across the board are reading this thing in the 13 colonies at this point, and are getting pretty riled up. Petrus, you want to read this one?
Yeah, okay. Hereditary succession. One of the strongest proofs of the folly of hereditary right of, in kings is that nature disapproves it. Otherwise, she would not so frequently turn it into ridicule by giving mankind an ass for a lion. Secondly, the giver of these honors could have no power to give away the right to posterity. And though they might say, "We choose you for our head," they could not, without manifest injustice to their children, say that our children and your children's children shall reign over ours forever. Because such an unwise, unjust, unnatural compact might perhaps in the next succession put them under the government of a rogue or a fool.
Right.
So it sounds like he's saying it's too arbitrary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no basis in reason. It's just you get to rule because your dad was this guy.
Right.
You could be an idiot.
Yeah. And he points out, too, where he says, if it was true that the argument that having this system maintains the greatest stability, if that was true, that would be a pretty lofty argument. But, and then he points out that there's been about 19 civil wars and like 13 revolutions in England in the past couple hundred years. And that includes the so-called Glorious Revolution, which if you get any British written history book, it's going to always refer to the 1688 period of the Glorious Revolution, which was a total bloodbath. And
was that Cromwell?
No, yeah, right, exactly. And that was when William of Orange came in. And here you got an English president, king, who never spoke a word of English. Right? Was that God's will? Here's a guy who just came in from, I think it was France or something, possibly France? Netherlands?
Netherlands.
Army of henchmen, placed there by the British, installed, killed a bunch of people. The Parliament just picked whichever side was the strongest, so they just went along with it. And Payne points out that, hey, under this reasoning, France should be, the Netherlands should be the ruler of England. Just like today, you know, England is somehow the ruler of America, which is on the other side of the world. Like, not very rational. So, this was the debate that was going on all across France as well. Across the board. And you could not have had a constitution or anything of that sort if this wasn't tackled. I figured I would include the writing of a guy who was a representative of the monarchist faction, the British Empire at that time, Sir Edmund Burke, quickly, on his Reflections on the French Revolution, which was written around the second year of the French Revolution as it proceeded, to give a certain sense of an opposing view to Thomas Paine, to get a certain sense of the rationality behind these guys. Now, Edmund Burke was writing specifically to attack the principled leaders around Marquis de Lafayette, a man who we're going to look a lot at today, whose name is Jean-Sylvain Bailly, who was effectively the Benjamin Franklin of the French Revolution. And he was attacking their concepts that Thomas Paine shared. Somebody else want to read this one? This is Sir Edmund Burke, Reflections on the Revolution in France in 1790.
Sure.
Oh.
You will observe that from Magna Charta to the Declaration of Right, it has been the uniform policy of our Constitution to claim and assert our liberties as entailed inheritance derived to us from our forefathers, and to be transmitted to our posterity as an estate especially belonging to the people of his kingdom without any reference whatever to any other more general or prior right. By this means, our Constitution preserves a unity in so great the diversity of its parts. We have an inheritable crown, an inheritable peerage, and the House of Commons and the people inheriting privileges, franchises, and liberties from a long line of ancestors.
So, do you guys see what the problem is with his assessment? Where do your rights derive as a people, from his mind?
From the king.
Yep. Right. Right. So he's justifying here the idea of hereditary succession by playing kind of dirty. So, you know, here we had these two things, 1200 and 1300, you know, AD, the Magna Charta and the Declaration of Right, two documents that gave people new rights from the king. And just like you inherited those, we have an inheritable crown, an inheritable peerage, and a House of Commons that a people inheriting privileges, franchises, and liberties from a long line of ancestors. So all of the rights that you have, they're not necessarily self-evident. They weren't already there. They're only there because you inherited them from your serfdom father and grandfather and whoever was alive when the Magna Charta was written. But that's it. And so thus, you'd be very hypocritical to try to criticize a king because he's just inheriting certain privileges just like you know? So. Right.
So for them, your rights are based on your genes.
Yeah.
Political rights.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like social Darwinism before Darwin is around. Now, this is going to play very importantly into the conceptions governing the different potential directions that the revolution could have taken and did take. Now, Paine had a conception that the legitimacy of the government is derived from the will or the consent of the governed. The common aristocratic view was that that's not so. There is arbitrary authority and absolute power that exists in this universe, and if you're not born into the right family, tough nuggies. The three ideologies that manifested in different parties in France that period were primarily divided along the Jacobin parties, or just the general anarchy parties, where if you asked any one of them, what do you plan on intending on instituting if you get your bloody revolution and kill the aristocracy? They wouldn't have had much of an answer, much like your modern day Marxist. You know, it's like, what do you do when the proletariat take over? Oh, we need revolution though. Oh, okay. So you had, on one hand, right, the anarchy faction. You had the British party, who were trying to institute a British style parliamentary system into France as an alternative. So we need a revolution, but just so we can get one of these things. And then you had...
Wait, the British were trying to institute some kind of system in France during the French Revolution?
Yeah, they were trying to do it in America too. That's why Paine had to really attack the British Constitution so heavily, because you don't want to fight a revolution with this tyrant just to adopt the tyrant's form of thinking and government, which is what a lot of the people were being duped into supporting, even in America. So the fight was, you know, is it going to be, what's the new form of system going to look like? Because a republic never existed. Mm-hmm. Right. So, same thing here. And you had people, and we're going to look at most of these, because the period that we're going to look at will address primarily the 2 years of 1789 to 90, where some of the more important decisions were made for the good and bad in France. And that party, the monarchist faction, is going to play a very important role as players on this little drama here. So what did you have? The first thing to understand is that you had a famine.
Did you say there were three parties?
Oh, the other party, yeah, sorry, I was cut off. It was the, thanks. You had the Republican faction of Marquis de Lafayette and Bailly. So the people who were instrumental in making the revolution a success in America, they formed their own, that was one idea thrust, which was, for a large part of the beginning at least, it was the strongest. the most influential and the most true. Well, it still is. So the monarchist faction was identified as being run and governed by two British dukes. On the one hand, you had Philippe Égalité, who was otherwise known as the Duke of Orléans, and the other guy was Jacques Necker, the finance minister of France. Now, we're going to investigate their role in undermining, for their own various intentions and reasons, the work by Marquis de Lafayette and Jean-Sylvain Bailly. The works I'm going to be using in the course of this case study are going to primarily be derived from a report or a series of reports that were written by a member in the States named Pierre Baudry, whom I encourage you all to read these reports as well, which I can email to y'all. The books, the source books that we're going to be quoting from are going to be from Memoirs de Bailly, of Jean-Sylvain Bailly. It's only going to be players. There's not going to be commentaries or anything. We're going to look straight at the people who are either passive or active players on the stage. You had Carl Friedrich Monjoie, who was a historian and an author, who had written Histoire de la Conjuration de Louis-Philippe de Joseph d'Orléans, surnommé Égalité, written in 1776, who had many insights and was on the ground watching firsthand this whole thing go down. And a ambassador from Venice to France, which was recently published, name's not coming to me right now, but it'll come up. Antonio something.
Gandhi?
No. And so I'm going to try not to be too quotey in the course of this presentation, but some things you just can't avoid. And to enrich the narrative as much as possible, we are going to rely, hopefully, on not too many quotes to carry us through the little flight through history here. So, okay, what made these guys such bastards? Well, we begin this drama, you could say, as a famine has already hit France for a couple of years. There's been the biggest hailstorms, the beginning or the most intense period of what we now know of today as being the Little Ice Age, a 40-50-year period of cooling where there really was no summers to speak of any sort in Europe and mid-Canada or in the world. And so the crops were devastated, people were starving, and instead of using the granaries, because it had been already come common custom at that point to store your food in case of you'd have natural disasters. So instead of using those granaries as they should, what you had from 1783 to 1788 was a series of negotiations by Égalité, his chancellor, Le Marquis of Ducrest, who I didn't have a painting of, and Jacques Necker, the finance minister, to organize the most radical series of free trade negotiations with Britain, which emptied out the entire harvests of France, of all of its grains, but based on the new radical agreements, made the holding of granaries, like food held over in case of a natural disaster, it made that illegal. So everything became open to the free markets, because then it was considered government interference upon the freedom of the markets. Okay. Sound familiar? So all the granaries had to be exploited. Britain bought up the sum total of most of it. And at this period, you had a scheme set up where Philippe Égalité, using his own massive fortune — he was the cousin of the king — got a whole series of investors to make loans to purchase up all of the grain, offering 40 to 60 to 75% interest, such that you could just make sure that there was going to be no food available anyhow, and you could monopolize it all. So, I mean, that's a huge interest. But he was willing to give them 75% interest on their loans to buy up this grain because he knew, knowing that the famine was hitting and getting worse, that he would be able to quadruple make a fortune selling it at the highest price, you know, anyone could demand. So this now created a situation of near revolt. Oh, by the way, anybody who wants to participate in this loan scheme, that asked any questions, that wants to know where their money was going at that point, it's interesting to note, we're not allowed to participate. So, so you can make money, but just don't ask questions.
Need to know basically.
Yeah, right.
All right. They need you to know.
So at this point, people were ready to riot. I mean, you had a real tension that was created, much like you see in the United States today, where people are losing everything and getting food, thinking about a way to feed your family is getting harder by the moment. You had Montjoie write in his book describing the situation, how this was all being manipulated. And he points out, he, in describing Philippe Égalité, imagined that he could take over the entire nation of France by gaining hegemonic control over the food of the entire nation by producing a general famine, by organizing so well his intrigues for that purpose that he would be able to persuade the people that the government was solely responsible for such a terrible calamity. He found also, in the scheme of starvation, the evil opportunity to push the inhabitants of the cities and the countryside into despair, and then to lead them from despair to insurrection. Furthermore, if he could gain total power after the destabilizations brought about by the famine, he would be assured to maintain himself in their usurpation by means of reestablishing abundance. So, right there. You have, basically what he's manipulating are certain levers in a scared population, which is that people will generally, if they're starving, blame the people who are ruling them as being incompetent to rule them. Right.
Are these the monarchists?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the monarchists actually led to the French Revolution.
Key ones. Some got pulled in. But the leadership, which is this guy, who had his own nefarious designs, because he did have an intention, which I'm going to get into. But yeah, the idea, I mean, whoever disposes of the king by overthrowing the system that caused the pain and gives them food will be loved. Simple formula. Every fascist knows about this formula. From, you know, Hitler to Mussolini to anybody.
Obama.
And Bush too.
Sure, yeah. Anybody wants to you wanna get into power and you're a fascist, you're gonna use that formula. Yeah?
Galit would have been not in power. He's just the king's cousin, so
yep.
He's trying to get power then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. He's third in line, fourth in line, behind the queen, Marie Antoinette,
okay.
The dauphin, who I don't understand what that is, and and then him.
Is he the accountant?
No.
No?
He has his chancellor, who is in determine these financial policies, the Marquis of Ducrest. He was the one that was sent over to England to negotiate the free trade agreements. But he's just rich as all hell. But the finance minister is Necker, who you might be thinking about. Now, this is the king. This is the queen. They're not going to be in our little drama for much longer. But the king was despaired at a certain point and begged Britain, just to give you a certain sense of the coldness of Britain and their role in this whole thing. He was begging them to sell his people 20,000 bags of wheat. So they had so much of it, like they're overflowing, more than their own people could handle. And after 2 weeks of going to deliberations, saying, you know, from one council to another to the Privy Council, finally it was decided, no, sorry, it's just, yeah, rules of the markets, you know, I'm sorry. deal with it on your own. So the king was despaired. C.F. Mojoy reports that not only was this help rejected, but the refusal was so harsh that a strict rule was further passed against any contraband or any fraud that might elude this edict. Thus the British, stuffed with our grains, mercilessly refused this poor Louis XVI a slight portion of sustenance that they had stolen from his own people. This rejection simply added to an already ravaging famine, and it was from that situation that the insurrection of July 14th emerged, and the heinous crimes of October 5th and 6th.
Sorry, Matt.
Yes.
Who was this Montjoie guy?
Montjoie, he was a historian. I think he was a professor in France at that point, on the ground.
So the French Revolution was actually orchestrated by the British.
Yep. That wasn't just rhetoric to get you in for the class.
And French Revolution consumed the Bonaparte guy, the Alexander Bonaparte guy?
That came after, yeah.
That was after.
Well, that was a necessary result. Yeah. So, at this point, enter Bailly and Lafayette. And what they had done behind the back of Necker, keep in mind, Necker and Egalite are very, very tight in this whole thing. Their conception, like I said, starve the population, overthrow the king, supply grain, become king. That's the plan. Necker also, in facilitating this process, created or convinced the king, he managed to sneak his way in as a close confidant, to create what were called the three estates. Yeah. The Estate General.
That existed.
Oh, I'm reading from Bo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe he manipulated them to behave to take on a certain form. That could be one thing. But he wants to utilize the Estate General to become converted into the layout for the British system. And the way this Estate General worked at that point was that you had, well, there were three, right? You had one was for the aristocracy. Right? They got 1/4 of the vote. Then you had for the clergy, the Pope, they got 1/4 of the vote. This is the general layout of the government. The king still had it was still an absolute monarchy of a certain sort, but this played a very important role. Then you had the third estate, which was generally the people. It had its problems, but it was generally the people. And that got a half. So, unlike the type of balance of power structure you had in Britain, with the House of Commons, House of Lords, and the King all maintaining sort of equal shares. Yeah. You didn't have that here. So the organizing, this was taken advantage of by Bailly specifically, who was able to utilize the one-half power and organize those within the aristocracy and clergy who had half a soul and a mind to think to support the conversion of this system of the Estate General into what we now know as the what became the National Assembly.
L'Assemblée Nationale. You forgot to write the
third one?
People.
Yeah, the people. Okay. I mean, you had to, I think, be a property owner or something, which excluded a big portion. It's like 2/3 of the people were excluded in a certain sense.
Would you call them the bourgeois people?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. You're not born there. You're just, yeah.
Okay.
So you had now the formation. This was disbanded in favor of National Assembly. National Assembly was convened very, very quickly in this time of crisis to deal with these problems of the bankruptcy of the nation, the famine, the necessity for instituting a Republican-style form of government very quickly, while the mass effect was in full full swing. So you can't wait too long with these things, right? If population are acting now, now's the time where you have to be the leadership for them. So Bailly understood this, and the people around him did too. This is a picture of Marquis de Lafayette, Bailly, right here. Bailly? Not yet. So, sorry. Now, their idea was to institute the principle, to get rid of the, keep in mind, what Thomas Paine was going for, you have to get rid of the hereditary principle, you have to destroy the British Constitution. You need a system where the will of the consent of the governed is the legitimacy of the government. Their institution, well, we should just read the Tennis Court Oath, because, yeah, we should read the Tennis Court Oath. This convened on June 20th, 1789. It's one of the most misunderstood or unknown parts of the French Revolution, where the National Assembly, under the leadership of Bailly, was intended to create a constitution for the nation, which is the defining moment that would determine how the unfolding of the legislation, the general predisposition of the government would behave. It's the constitution. He understood that very importantly. So you can't really have a nation if you don't have a solid one. And he attempted to set one up in the usual place of business. I forget the name of the parliament type area, but it was shut down. And the king at this point was being manipulated he was becoming very, very paranoid of the Assemblée Nationale, the National Assembly. And he was being induced to take measures that were completely against the interests of France. The first one was locking down this parliament area where they were planning on instituting an oath that would force all of the members of the Assemblée to remain together as they had in the U.S. in the 1787 Constitutional Convention until a firm principled constitution would be cracked out. And that was the arrangement, the way Benjamin Franklin was doing it 2 years earlier. So when nobody could get in, because apparently the story was, you know, the king was going to be giving a speech there in 3 days, so they had to prepare the assembly or the parliament. Bailly said, okay, fuck it, let's go to the tennis court. And so they went down to this sort of recreational area and had it there. And the oath effectively solidified the powers of the National Assembly as a republican institution within the monarchical system of France. So, you want to read it, Pascal?
Yeah, can you just erase it?
Oh, shit, yeah, sorry. Black on black, it's okay.
The Tennis Court of June 20th, 1789. The National Assembly, considering its role in establishing the Constitution of the Kingdom, in working toward the regeneration of public order, in maintaining the true principles of the monarchy, in assuring that nothing can prevent it from pursuing its deliberation, in whatever place it may be forced to constitute itself, and that wherever its members may be assembled, there stands the National Assembly. This assembly declares that all of the members shall, in a moment solemnly, swear to never depart and to assemble itself anywhere that circumstances will permit until the constitution of the kingdom is established and consolidated on solid grounds. And the said oath being sworn, all of the members, and each in particular, shall confirm this unshakable resolution with their signature.
Mm. So any contradictions in there from what we've been talking about so far?
Wait, just a second. Is he saying, like, okay, nobody's leaving till we do this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, no. Well, he's saying that we have to be together in this. We have to commit to make this oath that we will remain in collaboration until we crack out a constitution. It won't happen that day.
Okay. But, like, until that, no further business.
It keep it on track. They do other things. I mean, yeah, that's the priority. But other than that, do you see any contradictions in sort of the mission statement so far of the Assemblée?
Well, there's a kingdom.
Yeah, kingdom. You mean the monarchy?
True principles of the monarchy.
Yeah, right. Sort of paradoxical, right? Like true principles of the monarchy. Divine right of kings. Hello, is that a principle? This is what Pierre Baudry calls the French paradox, where you have a system set up that you could have a bloodless revolution. You could have the greatest good occur in the quickest time by setting up, and what Bailly had in mind was a king for and of the people. Right. So you get a republic system with the allowance of a monarchy. So you allow for a monarch to exist. Which seems, again, it's kind of like, what the hell? Aren't they just born there? But so, in his mind, because he knew also the king was generally a good, he wasn't a tyrannical king. He was played a lot, a little soft-minded, but he had true sympathy for the American Revolution. He was, you know, by testifies to the fact that he was a good man. And anything he did, he at least did because he thought it was for the welfare of the French people. So in this situation, maybe if it was a different king, he wouldn't have done so. But in this situation, he wanted to create a structure where the king would sort of serve as a president. Mm-hmm. And the will of the people would legitimize the king being there. And this is what he tried to convince the king profusely as a means of avoiding what he foresaw as being a bloodbath. The king goes in the opposite direction. And at that point, during the famine, you had already had certain crackdowns on the population who were getting riley. So if the king kept in that direction, he knew that it was going to go to hell. He describes here, right, this is in his memoirs, describing the assertion of the power of the Assemblée, where he writes, "This assembly, and infinitely small portion of the nation, felt nonetheless the force and the rights of the whole. It did not dissimulate the fact that it was acquiring for itself a sort of authority as a result of these rights and of this force, as can be attained by particular wills intended to compose the general will." The Assemblée was in a hurry to establish itself. We were told that the government was not happy with the firmness that the commons displayed, and the fear was that it could go beyond what the Estates General had been accustomed to do up until that time. Backed up with a legal representation of at least the majority of the communes of the kingdom, such an assembly had become formidable, because it was capable of executing any defensive actions, since it had power to give orders and was virtually assured of being obeyed. So you had the necessary power to form a government. You did not yet have the will of the king. The will of the people were there, but not the king.
Sorry, man.
Yes.
According to that, it sounds like they have like a check on the king a little bit, on the king's power.
Yeah, in a certain sense.
Because they have even more rights than the Etat General.
Yeah. Well, it definitely knocks the king's absolute power down quite a bit.
So,
and that's why the king was getting kind of threatened by it,
oh,
too. Because he had little people whispering in his ear, little Iagos, you know, whispering little sweet nothings about how Bailly wanted to overthrow him or something, you know? So
Bailly was kind of proposing a sort of constitutional monarchy in response to the upheaval.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I guess sort of trying to decompromise.
Yeah, in a certain sense, but on principle.
Yeah.
Well, I follow Matt.
Mm.
You said people were trying to put like intrigues in the king's mind, and maybe that's why he was a little bit
mm-hmm.
he was a little bit wary of giving the Assemblée Nationale that power.
Yep.
But didn't he know that the situation was degenerating?
I think the problem with kings is that they're kind of cut off a little bit, yeah.
Okay, yeah, maybe.
Who was Baihi?
Baihi was the president at this point of the National Assembly.
Okay.
He serves other functions later on. But yeah, I mean, the king, at one point, the day later, tells him, you know, because he asked the king, well, the only way for you to maintain stability is you have to take the you have to command the troops to leave. So at this point, the king's paranoia over the previous month had induced him to call in 100,000 foreign troops from the Swiss, Austria, and other lands to come in to his own nation just in case. Because he's freaked out, you know. He does know that people are ready to kill him. And so this is freaking out the population, though, too. Keep in mind, you know, you're walking around and you're seeing, like, all of a sudden these massive, you know, platoons of troops, 100,000 strong, come in with massive artillery, setting up barricades in every community of France. You know, it puts you on edge as an armed Frenchman, because most of the population at this point, kind of like today in America again, need to throw that out there, is also armed.
Well.
And well, a big part. Not to say that's a bad thing, it's you're right, but I mean still, it's something to be to keep in mind that was making the situation in the king's mind more paranoid filled. So anyhow, Bailly tells him, you know, get rid of these guys. We've got a National Guard here. Lafayette's the man. He's heading that thing up, which is working with the Assemblée. We'll replace it. We'll maintain the order. You just have to work with us. And the king says, well, hey, how about instead of me disbanding the military, foreign troops, how about you disband the Assemblée Nationale? So that doesn't go very well. That's the 23rd of June. Now,
and the revolution takes place in July.
Yeah, yeah, we're getting there. That's it. It's getting tight. So this is what the poet Schiller describes the littleness, both of the population, but of the king too, in his descriptions of the French Revolution as being, because he saw a great moment had found a very little people, and that was embodied in what the king had been induced to become as well. So what comes next? You jump the boat, but storm of the Bastille. Now, this is totally manipulated. It's crazy. This is just a joke. This is what the French population celebrate today. They've got a whole holiday for you. You get the day off work paid. This was a definitive moment of stupidity where... What'd you have? I mean, the fear on all parts created an environment where, well, okay, you gotta understand certain other key players, because allied with Necker and Philippe Égalité, you had an important commander of the Swiss army who was in command of 30,000 troops in, I think it was Versailles at this point. His name was Baron Bessenvel de Bronstadt. All right. Baron de Bronstadt was the commander who commanded his troops to fire on the civilian population in the beginning of May, previous month. Right. In that same area. This storming of the Bastille was the product of the enraged population from that act of effectively terrorizing your own population. Now, Bessenville, the week prior to this event, had also commanded, there's two letters where he commands the governor of the Bastille and another leader within the Bastille, which was the sort of a prison that didn't even hold that many prisoners at this point. It was kind of an unimportant fortress. But he commanded them to kill under all circumstances. He was going to supply them all the food, the weapons, the men. He actually promised them 10,000 men, which he never planned on delivering, through secret passageways under the Bastille, as long as they just did everything possible to you know, keep the population dead from coming before they would be allowed in. How did he know that? And he also had garrisons and gunnery areas built into the whole roof that didn't exist before the week before, right? Pointed to the area where the people were coming, whatever. So the first letter reads, I am sending you, my dear Dupuget, who is the director of the Bastille, the order that you know is necessary. You will carry it. The second letter reads to Monsieur de Launay, who is the governor of the Bastille. Monsieur de Launay will hold to the very last extremity. I have sent him sufficient forces. So he's commanding these guys to hold it down. Oh, shit. So, of course, at a certain point... At a certain point, the population, who's all... I mean, they're induced by just a general bloodlust at this point and hate for authority. And they're sort of called... They're herded towards taking over this post. They go in. They finally drop they get through the barricades. The first guards let their guard down, I guess. Forgive the pun. And their heads are immediately chopped off. They go in, kill everybody else. Heads roll. And that's pretty much the result of that. The following days, the population in such a frenzy is shouting, you have records all over where they're shouting, long live Necker, long live Duke of Orleans, right? Why the hell are they shouting these two assholes' names? That the main propaganda machine at that point was coming out of Orleans' estate, where you had people who some of you may have known already under the names of Marat. Robespierre wasn't in the game yet. Dalton? Who were, Marat especially, were main propagandists for the Jacobin faction and working with Robespierre just to focus people's anger against all things power, all things government, all things centralized as an attack on the constitutional or people like Bailly.
They were agents of Piquet or the Duke?
Yeah, they were all based out of his estate. He owned 13 square blocks or so, where you had the core of all of the, the prostitution, the gambling houses, the bars. Like if you judged a man by the company he keeps, this guy's a slimeball. That's where all the propaganda was coming from. So we know that. Montjoie has an interesting. Actually, I won't get into that yet, because the next thing. Is that while the population was shouting for Egalité and Necker to take over, Necker was supposed to be the prime minister of this British-style system when Philippe Egalité would become the king. Egalité was nowhere to be found. Right. This is another paradox that arises, because at this point, Egalité knew that he couldn't just take over, whether the population were asking or not. He still had the Dauphin, the king, the queen, So first he had to set up an environment where he had an alibi to be out of the nation while the king was killed. It gets interesting. So he asked the king for a leave to England because things are getting kind of shaky, and the king's like, all right, sure, go for it. Whatever. Now, Now, at this point, Pierre Baudry has done quite a bit of work in this, and there's a lot of firsthand accounts to describe it as well, but you had on the 12th of July, before the Bastille, right before the Bastille, or no, it was the 17th of July, sorry. Yeah, the 17th of July, or the day before, while the king was driving his carriage, at some point, it stopped before a bridge by some water. A song was sung, I forget what. And a woman in the audience around the king caught the bullet. She blew back, died 4 minutes later in the arms of two of the king's entourage. The doctors, the physicians who examined her body, discovered that the bullet, which is high caliber, came from above and across the little river, which is beside the king's chariot. And they pursued an investigation And at that point, Egalite was the man who would receive the blame. Like, people pretty much at that point generally knew Egalite was the guy that organized the assassination attempt. But it was determined at that point, because things were so on edge, that they should just cover it up and send him out. So they just said, all right, just take a vacation for a while and come back. The thing was hushed over. And there was a quote by Montjoie on this very thing, which is just totally explosive. No, this wasn't Montjoie. This is Antonio Capello, who was the Venetian ambassador writing back to a director in England, I believe, actually. The Duke of Dorset, that's it. So I don't know who has some air left in them. If you want to, can you read that from there? Or? Yeah, you can? You want to try it?
We have discovered during the investigations surrounding the last troubles that I mentioned to you, a conspiracy organized by the Duke of Orleans, which shows that his promotion of the causes of the Prince of the People was made only with the purpose of furthering his own evil designs. I will give you a more exhaustive report about the situation.
Conspiracy
of this perilous prince.
Perfidious
prince. I thought I could read better than I could. As soon as I am able to do it with full knowledge of the situation. For the time being, it seems to me that when he came cognizant of a plan projected by the
Queen,
and according to which the king was to leave Versailles to be transferred to Metz before he is forced to live in Paris. His first blood prince prepared an assassination of the king and his royal family during the trip, and later in the middle of a revolt being prepared to blow up in Paris. He would get himself nominated lieutenant general of the kingdom. We have discovered an arsenal of munitions of dual ball cartridges, and we have discovered that an arms manufacturer had already been contracted to produce, just by himself, 14,000 rifles. The commanding officer, Marquis de Lafayette, was to become the first victim. All necessary precautions have been taken. The national militia and the regular troops are activated without interruption, and no one was permitted to leave Paris until the day before yesterday. However, since it would have been dangerous in the middle of such a turbulent event to inflict upon the Duke of Orleans the punishment that he deserved, notwithstanding the fact that, being a member of the National Assembly, his person was considered inviolable and sacred, the decision was made to send him away. To cover this up, a special commission was devised as a pretext, and the king sent him on a mission the King of Britain.
Mm-hmm. So, alright, explosive. This could have all gone to hell now. at this point, you could have had a Jacobin king, people could have gone crazy. They were. But instead, that didn't occur. Oop. Because at this point, the organizing of Bailly, de Lafayette, and, I mean, now we're talking about the leading Republican minds and geniuses, scientists, poets, artists, in all of France were together in this conspiracy of Bailly's. It's okay.
Scientists, poets, and?
Scientists like Lavoisier,
yeah,
the great chemist,
poets,
statesmen, just in general, I don't know. But you had the greatest minds, basically, in art and science, were in on this together. And that's interesting to note, too. And so what do? They, at this point, Bailly and Lafayette became the leaders of Paris, unexpectedly. We're talking about the 25th of July now. So when everything is going to hell, these guys managed to pull out a huge coup for the good. The way this happened was the people in Paris were dying to know what was going on. They wanted news. Bailly had successfully arranged for the king to give consent to the legitimacy of the French Assembly at this point. So he goes to the people of Paris as a representative of the Assemblée, Marquis de Lafayette in arm, and he tells them, now, the king, on the July 17th, he says, the king had been deceived, but it is no longer the case. He knows our calamities, and he knows them so well that they will never happen again. The people cheered and demanded that he be elected mayor of Paris. Yeah. And they appointed de Lafayette, head of the Paris militia as well. So you had immediately one of the ambassadors from Benjamin Franklin write back to him, John Bonfield, said, your friend, Mr. Bailly, is chief magistrate in Paris, the Marquis de Lafayette, general and commander of chief. I am satisfied that you will be elated at the liberal sentiments that appear to reign. You will see in our archbishop's report that they are not innocent of the proceedings of America, which they quote as models. Okay. So, Lafayette now sees his duties as being twofold. One is to protect the king from the general mob, and to protect the Assemblée from intrigues in the royal court. So it's a certain delicate eggshell situation that he's finding himself in, and he works overtime over the next months to maintain that. Now, the issues are twofold. Bankruptcy, the whole nation is bankrupt, right? You had to deal with that. If you get an economic collapse, you're fucked. The population is starving. You got to deal with that. So that becomes the main focus of Bailly and his collaborators. The way that they deal with it is very ingenious, because this actually touches directly upon what LaRouche is proposing now with the HBPA. Because he makes sure that the Assemblée Nationale has the sole authority to issue public credit, issue taxes, standardize weights and measures, specifically take the debt, because you want to convert this massive debt that the nation's incurred and convert it to something useful, which is, this is exactly what Hamilton did in America, that time when all of the states in America, after fighting, investing in all this money in the American Revolution, all of the states were bankrupt, and the only way to resolve that was to create a national bank that could say, okay, we're going to federalize, we're going to nationalize the debt, but using the new mandate of the federal, of the national bank, you would now begin public works projects to issue good credit that would create real employment, but that would also have a benefit upon the productivity, the general quality of life of the nation by providing sanitation systems and canals and other great things, right? So that wasn't just an American idea. It was specifically, I mean, we can go into this later, this is a Leibnizian idea. Because the root here, in terms of, if you're following the ideas of what's occurring here, where Benjamin Franklin, Hamilton, were furthering and implementing the ideas of Gottfried Leibniz, the founder of physical economics, one of the greatest defenders of the rights of man that had died already two generations prior, a follower of Kepler. While they were doing that, instituting the system of government, the pursuit of happiness, which is defined by, this is a Leibnizian idea, it's not John Locke, this is a fraud, but this, they were instituting that, the physical economics of Hamilton was Leibnizian. Similar followers here, around Bailly, were all strictly putting forth the same concepts. It's Leibniz. And the projects that he puts forth are constructions of canals connecting Paris to the Marne River and to the Atlantic near this place known as Dieppe, which was eventually begun in 1799. Building of massive bridges, expanding streets, building tons of sewer systems, The good one that Bai came up with was demolishing the Bastille. So that would create employment, but it would also get people to put their destructive energy to someplace kind of useful. So this was totally attacked by the Jacobins. Marat, these guys were writing leaflet after leaflet. You know, L'Ami de la Peuple was the journal of Marat, attacking these guys as being corrupt, not actually saying anything, kind of like the way Barney Frank responded to Rachel's intervention. Nothing is said, but they allude to gossip. And after repetition so long, you actually start getting whispers, not just in the population, but in the own assemblée. People with soft minds start falling for gossip pretty easily. You want to ask a question?
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, when they model themselves after the National Bank in the United States,
yeah,
they set up a bank, they issue credit for those projects.
Yeah.
The productive output of those projects
mm-hmm.
is what, in turn, backs up the money that they print at the bank, and that way they're able to pay their national debt.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want a conception of the future state of your economy after you build such a thing?
So they start getting, basically they start getting economic projects to kind of like turn the economy over, you know, its internal.
Yeah, right. And you have to move from a monetarist system, which is what they had under the finance minister and under the, I mean, any free trade system is inherently, it's monetarist, it's money-based. So you're measuring the wealth of your society on a monetary dollar value. Whereas what the Hamiltonian national banking system, what Bai was moving towards, was a credit-based system, right? And that's based upon where you're, what you're building. And the credit is, or what is monetized, is a reflection of the increase of something useful being produced to your society.
So it's not just a bank lending you for profit. It's like a bank there just to provide you with the credit that you need to get a business going or
yeah.
to get a project.
Yeah, right. So that's the key for LaRouche's physical economics for anybody taking notes here. Got to keep in mind, this is how it works.
Yeah, what?
Don't pass out. That's the only lesson. All right. The next few months produce some of the most advanced revolutions in legislation in France. Like, putting a face to some of these names. Anybody hasn't seen Danton, Marat, and Robespierre? These are the... I mean, notice there, the consistent deaths. There's going to be a reason for that. Nobody in this place seems to last that much longer.
The
rules gather. So these are the sources of a lot of the all the intrigues. But regardless, even still, they're able to fight and institute the two groundbreaking pieces of legislation, which is on August 11, 1789, you had the abolishment of the feudal system in France. Landed aristocracy and the whole privileges of an elite class gone one day. August 26th, you had the Declaration of Rights of Man. A constitution, Article 1, National Assembly completely destroys the feudal regime. That's a good way to start a bill. And Jean-Sylvain Bailly writes on the great occasion, never... Oh, JP, you want to read this? Jean-Sylvain Bailly.
National Assembly completely destroyed the feudal regime.
Yep.
Never have so many individuals sacrificed so much and demonstrated so much generosity by voting in one concerted action and all at once. It is the night of destruction of privileges and of public happiness. The feudal system that weighed on the people for centuries has been destroyed in one blow and in an instant. The National Assembly had accomplished more for the people in those few hours than the most wise and enlightened nations have done ruling many centuries.
Mm-hmm. And I just excerpted the preamble. The Declaration of the Rights of Man, in some ways, has some compromising qualities to it, in the sense that it's not as strong as the American Declaration of Independence, But the spirit in many cases flows in the same way, especially the preamble, which, JP, you want to keep going for this?
The representatives of the French people form into a national assembly, considering ignorance, forgetfulness, or contempt of the rights of men to be the only causes of public misfortunes and the corruption of governments, have resolved to set forth in a solemn declaration the natural, unalienable, and secret rights of men, to the end that this declaration, constantly present to all members of the body politic, may remind them unceasingly of their rights and their duties, to the end that the acts of the legislative power and those of the executive power, since they may be continually compared with the aim of every political institution, may thereby be the more respected, to the end that the demands of the citizens, founded henceforth on simple and uncontestable principles, may always be directed toward the maintenance of the Constitution and the happiness of all.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah.
I just had a question. Where was Napoleon at this time?
Ah, we'll get there. So things at this point are looking good. And then shit hits the fan. Abruptly. We have now... To give you guys a fuller sense, I'm not going to go through this, but I set up a bit of a timeline to go through just how things... completely just screwed up very, very abruptly, very badly. And the following 4 or 5 years are, they're backwards. Well, actually, first, here, let's just read this quickly, too, because this is an embodiment, this is an embodiment of the principled concepts, I think the clearest form that they've manifested in France at this point, which was from what's called the Society of 1789, founded ironically in 1790, by Bailly. And the main flank was science, art, and the institution of Leibnizian academies across France. So this is really, it's not a political or economic battle, it's primarily, it's a cultural battle. You got to elevate the culture if you're going to have a population that doesn't go Jacobin. But the mandate here, I think, is sound. And so we'll read this first before we go through the crazy shit to have something to compare it to. I'll read it. There exists for individuals an art of assuring and maintaining their happiness. Up until now, it has been developed in moral philosophy and elevated by the ancients to some sort of perfection. There must also exist for nations an art of extending and maintaining their felicity. This is what we have called the social art. This science, toward which all others strive, does not seem to have been examined in its totality. The art of cultivating, the art of commerce, the art of government, even the art of reasoning, are merely portions of that science. They have all developed themselves, each on its own, separately. But no doubt, these isolated members will succeed in their complete development only when they are brought together and form a well-organized body. Reuniting so many inconsistent and separate parts, searching into the economic sciences, their mutual relationships, and most of all, the common relationship that they can have with the general science of civilization, such as the object of the social art. It is not one, nor many human beings, neither a single nation. It is the concert of peoples which can assure that this art will undergo efficient progress. But this progress will accelerate as soon as the minds shall follow everywhere an orderly task that is constant and uniform. This general common, or this common method must therefore be created. But before it can be established, perfected, and generally accepted, it were natural that its foundations be laid by an association which, by communicating the principles and the spirit which animates it with other similar societies, could, like them, assemble among similar systems the different results of all enlightened men, wherever they may be, and take care of the good of humanity. This is the plan upon which the Society of 1789 has been founded.
Sounds like a real threat to the old one.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like they were on the cusp of what the Americans accomplished in 1787.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, figure it. If you want to get the opposing polarity, where the oligarchy gains its power by dividing, its idea of one, of oneness,
mm-hmm.
is of a divided sort.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually looking at all of these different aspects of society, of reasoning, and these different sciences, where the social art, which hadn't yet formed, is of figuring out how they're one, how they're common. Which you could sort of say, I mean, this is the root of physical economics, which as a science... still is not yet accepted by the general mass of society today.
I would say that that's the real statesman that can bring all those segments of the population together and work in a concerted way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Towards a real principle.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's a battle of concepts and principles, and the oligarchs has always do the same thing to control governments and countries. So
yeah. Well, check out what they're going to do now to get a sense of the good and how the good is responded to. Because keep in mind, the oligarchy doesn't come up with creative acts. The oligarchy, what it does, is responds to the good in a way that sees the good as a threat and that it adapts itself in such a way that it crushes the good. So it itself is not creative. It doesn't change on its own. Right? It's like evil is a force unto itself, like many people think. Evil tends to manifest only as a negation of the good. So
it's reactionary, you mean?
It's reactionary.
It's never innovates, never invents, never.
No, not actionary. Reactionary. All right. This is going to get crazy. I'm going to breeze through it, okay? If anybody wants to stop me, don't. October 1789. You've got a women's march in response to the National Guard's declaration of loyalty to the king and queen. The king goes with the women from Versailles to Paris and is held at Paris at the Palace of the Tuileries. This was under the advice of the Marquis de Lafayette, who said if you don't go with the women who are leading this march, they're going to kill you again. So go with them. Cooperate, people will be happier. Yeah, right. So spring 1790. There's a conflict between the Republicans and the Jacobin extremists. Summer of 1790, the mutinies all over are all over the place, because in the armies, what occurred is that to still be an officer in the army, you have to be of a certain family. Right, so the privilege were not destroyed in the armies, and that causes mutinies where the Marquis de Bouille, who was one of the collaborators of the Marquis de Lafayette, was forced to put some of these mutinies down and ended up killing 24 mutineers. And Lafayette, who doesn't attack him, he approves of it, because he had to maintain order in some measure, is labeled in the eyes of the population the enemy. Now, a point in here, interesting to note, there's a point in the Marseillaise, the French national anthem,
mm-hmm.
which is a total bloody anthem if anybody's listened to it. It's like, we're going to make our fields run with the blood of unpurified. it's really, for a national anthem, it's intense. So part of that comes from the Marquis de Bouille, who is the tyrant in the national anthem. Pope Pius, in 1791, Pope Pius VI issues a bull for all clergy to denounce and oppose the edict which stops the feudalism. Right, so he said, there was that edict that, you guys remember that one? Okay. So this creates a schism inside the church. June 1791, the king and queen tried to escape from France across the Rhineland at Varennes. And they were about 20 minutes away from Marquis de Bouillé, who at this point, with his new army, was waiting for him outside of France at the border. And he was recognized and stopped by the townsfolk at Varennes, and was returned back to the Tuileries, the palace of the Tuileries. July 1791, Lafayette orders troops to fire on the bloodthirsty mobs who were demonstrating against the monarchy at Champ de Mars. This doesn't go well. Extremists are now at this point divided into two groups. You've got on the one hand les Girondins, and on the other hand you've got the Jacobins. Now the Girondins, they get their name because, well, whatever.
I heard it was from the church that they used to associate out or something.
Close. It's from an area. There's a Ville de Girondins in France.
Okay.
In the West.
Right, right.
The Jacobins, they hung out at the Jacobin Club. So that's where the name's coming from. So June 1792 to July 1792, you have the Duke of Brunswick, who's the leader of the Prussian army. He issues a statement to the people threatening them not to hurt the king or queen or else. That's a bad thing to do to an enraged population. So the revolutionary mob on August 10th, 1792... they storm the Tuileries, they imprison the king, and make sort of a bastardized republic. August 15, 1792, Lafayette condemns the revolutionaries and declares his support for the monarchy. He's declared a traitor, and before he's killed, he runs away to Austria, where he's imprisoned for 5 years as a revolutionary. Because all of the kings at this point across Europe, they're pretty paranoid, you know. And you've got everyone sort of seeing that, you know, you've got Masonic lodges running the revolutions in France, and that they want to do it in your kingdom too. So the kings at this point are, they're just freaked out.
What is it?
Huh?
Masonic lodges? What
yeah, you've got, I mean, the Masonic lodges are all over the place, and they're playing a huge role. Like, Philippe de Gaieté is the Grand Master of the Orient Lodge in France.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, almost a coincidence, huh?
Hmm.
Hmm. So, you know, all of the kings now, like Catherine the Great, bans them all. The king of Austria bans them. So you got a huge crackdown, because even inside, no two lodges are the same. And in some cases, you have the revolutionaries using them, like Marquis de Lafayette, George Washington, were actually in there. These lodges were the best way to maintain cover and create a conspiracy. And that was going across. I mean, every nation had the good and the bad. Most of the bad was coming from England. That's where the shit originates in its most vile form. So anyhow, go on. Moving on, you got January 1793. Danton, he says that, well, the kings of Europe are attacking us. Let us throw down to them as a challenge the head of a king. So Louis, right, gets sentenced to death. October 1793, Marie Antoinette is guillotined. January 20th, 1793, Louis XVI is guillotined. July 13th, 1793, Marat is assassinated by a Girondin woman in a bathtub. She is guillotined. 1793 summer, the Girondins defeated the Jacobin authorities and guillotined a Jacobin leader. The Jacobins then suppressed the revolt and guillotined dozens of Girondin leaders. At this point, most of the Girondins were all Freemasons at this point. Jacobins were generally not. They're more like for the people, so to speak. And Freemasons have sort of an implicit hierarchy within them in the mystery schools. So that was sort of shunned upon by the Jacobins. Then the Jacobins, when they take over, they abolish all the Masonic lodges, kill thousands of Masons, good and bad alike. Mostly, actually good in this case. October 1793, Marie Antoinette is guillotined. November 1793, all the Girondin leaders are guillotined. Philippe Galite, he tried to renounce his grand mastery of the Freemason Lodge, but it was a little too late at this point. They're like, no. No, they're sticking to their principles. So,
sorry, buddy.
Yeah.
Died in the wool.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, here we go. Then Robespierre, who's the big provocateur of the Jacobins, he gains control of the government now in 1794. Danton and Desmoulins in April 1794 were guillotined for being too moderate. Thomas Paine, who was in France at this point, was accused of being a Girondin and was imprisoned and sentenced to the guillotine. But in his case, the guard, when he painted the "this guy's got to be guillotined" mark on the door, painted on the wrong side of the door. So that when the door closed, he was safe.
Yeah.
But he still spent quite a few years in prison. Then on July 27, 1794, Robespierre rose in the convention to announce a list of deputies who were traitors to be guillotined. And this is where the strategy becomes sloppy, because he says, after lunch. And, of course, right before lunch was over, he was attacked, because everyone's now paranoid, like, fuck, is it my list? Am I on the list? Am I on the list? It's like McCarthyism, you know? So they nailed back, calling him a traitor, and he's guillotined. And, right, so this leads up to 1795. The Assemblée is disbanded. Everyone alive is, like, guillotined. And what's called the Directory is set up. The Directory is the new form of government. Total decadence, luxury. I mean, it's just aristocratic bullshit. But that doesn't go on very long either, because at this point, the population is so demoralized, people are fucked in the head. There's no leadership anymore. They're all guillotined. That Napoleon easily comes in, picks up the pieces, and declares himself the consul and emperor of France.
In what year?
That was 1799.
1799?
Yeah.
Napoleon's...
Yeah.
Where does he, like, hail from? Where does he step from?
He's France. He's French.
Is he a Mason? Is he
no.
He's a military
general. He's a general, right.
He's
financed by the British. Like the, you know, you have the British. He's France. He's French.
Is he a Mason? Is he
no.
He's a military general.
He's a general, right.
He's are you general?
He's financed by the British. Like the, you know, you have the British. He's France. He's French.
Is he a Mason? Is he
no.
He's a military general.
He's a general, right.
He's
financed by the British. Like the, you know, you have the British. He's France. He's French.
Is he a Mason? Is he
no.
He's a military general.
He's a general, right.
Are you general?
He's financed by the British. Like the, you know, you have the British. He's France. He's French.
Is he a Mason? Is he
no.
He's a military general.
He's a general, right.
Are you general?
He's financed by the British. Like the, you know, you have the British banks, primarily. They finance both sides of the war. That's where the Rothschilds made most. They multiplied their fortune by like a multiple of 20 or something at that point, because they financed both sides. And he bragged about it all the time. This guy Amschel Rothschild.
He hedged his bets.
Seriously. But no, he wasn't a Mason. But he did reinstate the Masons, and he was controlled by Masons, like.
He's a French general.
Yeah, he was a Messiah. He had a Messiah complex, and he was a beast man. He's like a Dick Cheney of its day. Joseph de Maistre. That's the name I was thinking of. Yeah, from the Martinist Freemasons. Yeah, and de Maistre.
Freemason is an invention of Britain?
No. That could be a discussion after the class.
Okay.
But anyhow, he had his controllers who were Masons, and who also wrote about how they were going to control him. And the idea of taking a psych profile of somebody who is a Napoleon character and modeling it to be your fascist that you control from the background was the same model used to apply to create Mussolini, Franco, Hitler, Barack Obama, Dick Cheney. Same model. It's no different quality. Yeah?
I remember hearing that a lot of the people to die were like what you were talking about before, the scientists, the leading members of society, the artisans, the poets, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, how much of the regular people actually got? Was it like a lot of little? Do you have any like idea of what the scope was?
I don't have any stats, but I think by and large it was anybody who qualified as being as having authority. Anybody who smells like Because the idea is there's the leadership, there's the government, and then there's you as a proletariat. So anybody who seems like they might be of within an aristocracy or within a privileged class or within whatever, a leader, like Robespierre. I mean, this guy wasn't a hypocrite. He would kill everybody because he's an anarchist. You know, he's following his principles, anarchy. And I guess he couldn't complain when he got his head chopped off. But that was the case. It was the leadership is the... I mean, if you think back to the beginning of the class, if you don't have those minds who have the identity of leader within them in these times of mass phenomena which occur, you have only chaos that occurs, and fascism is necessary, or is inevitable, I guess. So the people, what better way than have the people arbitrarily do it to themselves, like kill their own leadership, which is their own salvation, than do something rational. Which you could imagine, I mean, when you're organizing with us and, you know, people are telling you, oh, LaRouche, he's a fascist, you know, never read a thing by LaRouche, but, you know, here they are willing to just shun, you're their best friend. Best thing you do for them is kick their ass a little bit because they're not thinking. And, you know, but that's the case here.
Napoleon wasn't part of, like, Jacobins or any faction?
No. He just came in. Well, he cleaned up. He was utilized. Same way Mussolini's black shirts came in and cleaned up after Italy. Take power, same thing. This leads us to Percy Shelley. Because this is really what it's all about. And LaRouche points again and again in his papers that the only way you can understand anything from physical economics to science to history to anything to your own identity is through the mind of Percy Shelley, especially in defense of poetry, which he relates to Bernard Riemann's habilitation dissertation as sort of the sister. Like, they go hand in hand. It's not art and science. This is the most scientific example of poetry. And I need a volunteer to read the very last quote here. Luc Trudeau.
All right. We live among such philosophers and poets as surpassed beyond comparison any who have appeared since the last national struggle for civil and religious liberty. The most unfailing herald, companion, and follower of the awakening of a great people to work a beneficial change in opinion or institution is poetry. At such periods, there is an accumulation of the power of communicating and receiving profound and impassioned conceptions respecting man and nature. The persons in whom this power resides may often, as far as regards many portions of their nature, have little apparent correspondence with that spirit of good of which they are the ministers. But even whilst they deny and abjure, they are yet compelled to serve the power which is seated upon the throne of their own soul. It is impossible to read the compositions of the most celebrated writers of the present day without being startled with the electric life which burns within their words. They measure the circumference and sound the depths of human nature with a comprehensive and all-penetrating spirit, and they are themselves perhaps the most sincerely astonished at its manifestations. For it is less their spirit than the spirit of the age.
So Shelley's writing this in a positive light because he's living and watching the American revolutions and seeing that people are doing the good, and not all of them are cognizant of the good that they're actually performing. But in the same regard, this is like the early 1800s. Yeah, right. I mean, in the same regards, this could also be for the bad too, where people act. But you've got a phenomenon in society that, again, has to be taken advantage of. And it doesn't come every day. So that's the class. Questions? Mm-hmm.
When he says it's less their spirit than the spirit of the age, is he saying that like events are kind of events that are happening are kind of inspiring them to do what they do?
Yeah, I think I had trouble battling that one out, but I think what this is you have an age which is being like a, you have a certain wave being defined by certain ideas being applied.
A cultural wave?
Well, you got, I mean, a Benjamin Franklin, you've got a small group, a core, who set forth a dynamic, and it's like you can't necessarily explain why it is that you're inspired to, like a lot of the people who are fighting the, take for example, on the time of even Martin Luther King, a lot of the music which started off in that period through the Council on Congress for Cultural Freedom, it was generally created and crafted to be degenerate music anyhow, to really just numb people's minds in the 60s. But the effect of Martin Luther King's life and his battle with the population as a moral leader had the effect where even the debauched music took on the characteristics of having, of carrying forth high ideals. The quality of the music still might have been pretty debauched, but, I mean, certain revolutionary music couldn't deny the fact that there were higher principles seeping through there, so that people were, I mean, it wasn't necessarily of their own volition, you couldn't say necessarily, but yet, it was. So, but there's that higher age that was being sort of created. And, I mean, it was the time of JFK, of Robert F. Kennedy, too, so there was a certain air of optimism, which, if they weren't there, you can't say would have necessarily have been there. Even if you didn't know their names. You
know? I think it's also the fact that if you're thinking about revolution, you might try to find people that were bred into like some type of revolutionary culture since they were 4 years old, right? Mm. You can like immediately listen to Mozart when you're like two, and then in this whole curriculum of the so-called revolutionary. Well, actually, that's not. Revolutions don't work that way. You don't necessarily need, as I say, it's less your spirit than the spirit of the age. So even if you might be yourself screwed up in culture, like most youth in Canada or the United States, despite that, the spirit of the age is such that leadership will come from those people, even though they're far from the perfect image that we have of a Luther King or a Gandhi. Yeah, they're supposedly like bulletproof revolutionaries. That's what I think that in a sense that's what we see in the U.S. There's this Jacobin thing, but with our intervention, it's become able to guide backward people towards a position of leadership, which they would not even have considered a year or a few months ago. And they do things that is not from their culture, but is from the spirit of the age.
Right. I think being self-conscious about it too, because if you're in a situation like we are, where the age doesn't necessarily supply you a spirit of good, there's nothing really within our age that will do that. The only way out of that catch-22 is to go to the higher points of a previous age and take the best of that, of the Renaissance and whatever greatest ideas that are possible. And to do that, you can't do that by accident. It doesn't happen like, oh, I just stumbled, you know, bounce into a Plato book or something, you know? So you... I think the qualifications for leadership generally, I mean, you have to be sort of self-conscious about these things. And then as you influence others, like Rachel Douglas is doing at these town hall events and others, there's maybe they might be a little less self-conscious of it because they've not, you know, gone to past ages to develop themselves, but they're inspired by you guys, you know, by us. And you want as many people to know why they're behaving in a certain way, what's to be fully conscious of these things.
Do you think higher ideals can permeate such cultural offshoots as, you know, as are expressed in our in musical culture or artistic culture, but in a way that just kind of spins them around to become more elevated?
Well, I think like a good revolution, you have to break certain axioms that are false. There are certain things which don't exist, but that we, only human beings can live. We can make mistakes, like a rabbit, you know, just it's just being a rabbit, no matter what it does. A lion eats a rabbit, it's not being a bad lion, it's just being a lion. Or an orbit, planets going around in an orbit, and it's just being a planet. Whereas when you introduce the will, we can do things for an illusion, because our imagination is just, whether have wrong ideas, wrong reasons to thinking or whatever, and act accordingly. So we can make mistakes. And so I think what we have here is the necessity to look at the universe as it is, or harmony, for example, as it is, investigate that to the greatest that we can know it till now, so that we already have an idea of what already is implicit in the universe before there was even an Earth. And then with that knowledge, take again a look at the question of what our own music qualifies our music and our culture as being, you know, enjoyed or liked or good or bad. So I think that that's the key thing you want to do first, is to look at how did Kepler discover the harmonies? What is the sound of a pentagon? How is that so important? You know, I think that will enrich your mind to the point that you know, we could tackle these other questions. Because I don't think you could necessarily recombine that which exists today into something good. Like, I don't think you could have recombined. Well, it's like the could you have recombined the elements of the British monarchy before the revolution in America? Just recombine the elements to form the constitutional republic system?
I guess not. But
you mean the revolution or the music?
The music, for instance.
Well, I think I want to take the best.
Well, that's just something I'm asking myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's ongoing.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. Yeah.
Why was it that during those that decade of the 1790s, everything just degenerated so quickly?
1790s? Oh, you mean that thing that I just read really quickly?
Yeah. Why did Bayeux and Lafayette fail, whereas like a guy like Napoleon comes along and picks up the pieces afterward, quite easily, actually?
Well, Bayeux writes later on that while the Assemblée, the formation of it, and the Tennis Court Oath were probably the greatest moments in French history, it was only known about by a minority of maybe a handful of leaders who were participants. Whereas something like the storming of the Bastille was seen by everybody, and there's more glamour, you know. But that's the thing. I mean, you just had a population that wasn't able, through various reasons, to respond to recognize those ideas that were necessary for its salvation. And
but they were under serious pressure too, after years of famine, and all kinds of crazy things going on
for
in society.
Yeah, right.
It's like, do you think then that ultimately the guy, the Duke of Orléans, his plan actually, even though he died,
mm-hmm.
his plan to destabilize the country through the grain speculation
mm-hmm.
and other, you know, motive.
Well, it was British. He was owned by the British Foreign Office, Jeremy Bentham.
They they were able to foment that type of chaos through all kinds of different crises.
Sure.
To degenerate the population.
Yeah, that's not hard to do. You know that people, if they're, people get scared. If you can create environments where people are scared, you know that they're going to want to not be scared. So if you can have both those things in your mind, it's like September 11th or the burning of the Reichstag, Reichstag. People who did that weren't geniuses. They just knew how to scare people and keep a secret. So, but that's what we're looking at here, right? It's the same principle as September 11th. It's like if you could imagine in the future, this is the craziness of having a Bastille Day. You can imagine in the future somebody having a September 11th day and having that as a national holiday.
Yeah.
There are certain things that qualify you for leadership. And if you don't have that, Napoleon, he's just a messiah complex egomaniac. You'll be utilized. You'll be a tool.
So what's this beast man thing about Napoleon?
You pick up our Children of Satan book, then it goes through some of this stuff with Joseph de Maistre.
Those humping goats?
Kind of. Probably.
Probably.
Yeah. Probably important.
That was just off the top of my head. But.
Yeah. No. Generally speaking, from what I have read, he's under the profile of the executioner. You need, in order to do the disgusting shit, to burn the Reichstag, to kill a bunch of, to create Holocaust, to create a Holocaust, you need somebody who's got no empathy and who's full of themselves. And that's generally it. And de Maistre just wrote down how that would be done. He intellectualized it and made it a mandate. Just said how to do it. But we have a whole pamphlet on Children of Satan with Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and going through this whole beast man thing.
That sounds like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Well, it's doing something which is
Michael
so horrible that it'll keep people quiet.
Yeah.
A beast man is like someone you would never confront ever, because what he does is just horrible.
Yeah.
You say, oh my God, if I'm to provoke this guy, and we're all dead. That's how these beast men are used.
Uh-huh.
But it's ironic that Obama seems to flip the beastman archetype on its head, because he's saying, instead of ruling people through fear, he's kind of ruling you through guilt, like guys like him and Gore, by saying, look, this has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do it, or else you're going to have yourself to blame.
Right.
It's probably not a beastman per se, it's just controlled by beastmen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's what the behavioral economists are saying to the population, too. They're saying that it's your lifestyle, all the debts, and all your
so they flip it.
Yeah, yeah.
They flip it against you and say, it's you, buddy.
Yeah.
You're the problem.
Exactly. They're taking their money and blaming the American population, too.
Mm-hmm. But you look at Greece, for instance, for this, and you see that, what we're dealing with now with Obama in this intense form of liberal sophistry is exactly the type of thing that Plato was up against to a T with Pericles. It's not that different. Guy just gives everybody anything that they want to say. Anything they want to hear, he gives them. And the population the sophism. Just again and again, he'll tell you anything. And he'll spin it to make himself sound like a hero. But in the meanwhile, what's happening to Athens in the course of Pericles' reign? And Socrates is there providing you the solution on how to get out of it. Every time he's tackling a sophist, it's right there.
Degenerated into tyranny, finally, just like what happened in France.
Mm-hmm. Well, if that's the danger with Obama, is that currently, you see what he's done now with the Constitution. The Honduran president, a puppet for George Soros, a big drug, narco-trafficker, tries to change his own constitution to allow himself to run multiple times, right? The Congress just does its job, puts him on a plane in his pajamas and sends him off to Nicaragua. Obama comes to his aid saying, constitutions are great and all. That's what Obama says the next day on the camera, Constitutions are great, but sometimes they just stop you from making the really tough decisions.
right? Said that verbatim.
Yeah, because he wants to kill people. He knows that the effect of his policy is anti-constitutional. You know, so yeah. So you look at he's he knows the consequences. I think he's more self-conscious than we think, but he knows that the general welfare clause does not. Apply to what he wants.
Supposedly LaRouche says Obama was there because of the British Empire too, you know, George Shaw was working with the chairman of the Democrats, Howard Dean, I think. Was it Howard
Dean? All these guys.
And yeah, all these guys worked with the British Empire and George Shaw was working with this guy and he directly put Obama, they completely knew that this could happen, they could control Obama.
Yeah.
Supposedly they killed like two or three supporters of Clinton. She backed up, and then Obama got in the game, and running the White House by with their own hands.
Yeah, it was where you need people have an idea of natural
how
law.
How was the Clinton beaten at the Denver convention?
I forget. But in general, I'm not too sure. If you know, I don't know.
She was beaten.
But at one time, Clinton was like the hope of...
I know in Michigan... Yeah, right. Because she won in Denver, and then in Michigan, you know, she won, but then Obama's name wasn't in, so none of the voters were registered. They weren't acknowledged, and so you had a big operation though. I think at the root of this whole discussion though is just natural law. Like, you've got the two conceptions where an imperial sort of blank slate conception is that you have the rights. You have that's the government. Has given you those rights, and that's why they're there, right? That's why rights exist. Whereas on the other point of view, that of the founding fathers, the idea of the soul is primary. It's not like you've just had rights impressed upon you as a blank slate, but you already have, because you're a human and you're not a monkey or a cow, you have inalienable rights implicit in your existence and that you have to defend. And so Obama obviously doesn't have a conception of inalienable rights of man. Yeah, obviously. Just by virtue of what he does and how he thinks.
The healthcare policy.
Yeah. And any population that had a moral fitness to survive would identify that immediately. That, no, there's universal rights, things are sacred, and then there's what you're doing. And they'd organize themselves on that basis. So that's what we have to bring to bear and figure out a way to communicate that to people, because they don't know that they have inalienable rights. They really don't. There's the rich and then there's the poor, and that's, you know, money makes the world go around. That's where your rights come from. That's, you know. So.
That's what you call the monetarist view.
Yeah. Yeah, you're owned by the money. The money gives you rights. Africa, well, you know, they shouldn't be so poor. Sucks, but, you know.
So, like, about what LaRouche talks about and whatever he thinks or whatever he wants to develop, like, if we manage to repair the ongoing monetary financial breakdown across the United States and around the world,
mm-hmm.
after managing to complete this, crisis and fix the economy, how could we, from that point, manage to develop what LaRouche wanted to develop, the Southeast Asia, Africa, South America? Would LaRouche work with a different president, or would LaRouche be a president himself? How could we manage to get on with the plans of developing the world as LaRouche was planning?
You gotta be.
Me?
Yeah. Well, you gotta see yourself as a statesman.
Yeah.
Of the highest quality. Which, I mean, most of us don't do on a regular basis.
Yeah.
But if you have that idea, that identity that you have to fight for, it doesn't come like that. But then you're able to think about policy, because it doesn't really matter who happens to be occupying a seat of power, but if they're a human being, you know that there's certain policies that are, they're already implicit in the universe, that are necessary because they're good. And they're good because they're necessary, that they will respond to. And they may need to be organized by you to see that.
Okay.
Because they've got certain other assumptions in their mind that prevent them from seeing what you see.
Uh-huh.
So.
So you have to be there to accompany whoever's going to occupy the seat of power in order to
you don't have to hold their hand, but you have to see the power of an idea, right? Like it has a certain indirect influence as these people who act but not knowing that they're the ministers of the good. That's the spirit of the age.
If they're not human beings, like these behaviorists, what then do you do with them?
Then you put them in a little box or some shit.
Boxes.
You might need a couple
big
of
lock.
Guillotines for
so,
that.
<You're right>.
fit them all in a little box.
I've heard about the spirit of the age.
Yeah.
Spirit of the age, but what is it? I've read in a,
what
in
you should
a
do
German
is,
word for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's the definition of the spirit of the age? Meaning the opportunity.
Zeitgeist.
Zeitgeist.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we've talked about
the zeitgeist already.
It's
like Lindsay Lohan, Britney Spears,
and Paris. That's like the zeitgeist of the day, I guess, maybe.
I guess
you could consider that.
Does that come from
I don't know.
The popular saying or the popular...
it's the spirit of the age. Let's think of it that way.
Okay. So
what we should do is read that. We should set up a moment to read through Shelley's In Defense of Poetry. Huh? What do you think? Have you ever read Shelley, Percy Bysshe Shelley? That'd be a good idea. We could maybe even do that tomorrow, if you guys want. It's like 20 pages,
so yeah,
and you just got a taste of it.
Supposedly.
Yes.
Right, tomorrow.
What?
When's tomorrow conference?
The what?
Which o'clock is it?
It's September 8th.
What's tomorrow?
The next webcast?
Yeah,
what you should do here, think about this. Tomorrow, because I'm going to give you like a little sketch of the next.